This is Fresh Air. At the age of 12, Tulani Davis was chosen to be one of the black students to integrate a white school in Virginia. She was prepared for the experience by her father and her teacher, in vain as it turned out, because the integration plan never went through. But it was still the beginning of the end for segregation in Hampton, Virginia. That same year, several young black men sat down at a local Woolworth's lunch counter, and soon the blacks of the town were boycotting white businesses. These experiences are the inspiration for Davis's new novel, 1959. This is Tulani Davis's first novel. She used to write about African American issues for the Village Voice. She also wrote the libretto for the opera X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X. The opera is about to be released on CD by Gramavision. I asked Davis how she felt about being chosen to integrate the school.
Really ambivalent. I think it was mostly frightening to me. I am actually glad I did not have that experience in the end. I think in black communities in that era, children grew up with a tremendous sense of responsibility drilled into them that, you know, you're a representative of the race and you must go forward and do well. We all had that. But the pressure that I think kids had on them who went to those schools, I think it could barely be shared with anyone else. I think it was a pretty isolating experience.
In your novel, the father at first really is opposed to sending his daughter to this white school to integrate, but then he realizes that it's for the benefit of the civil rights struggle, and he feels that the family has a responsibility to participate. What was the process that your father went through in thinking it out? Do you remember?
Well, my father was very unusual, and he did a lot of his thinking aloud in my presence, so I knew he had a lot of misgivings about it. He told me he was very frightened for me personally. That was his main misgiving about it. And at the same time, I think he was proud that they thought his kid could make it through something like that. He had had many experiences like that himself in his own life, so he had a good idea, I think, what it would be like and what it would take. And I think, like most parents, he wasn't sure that his children were as tough as he had had to be in his life, because most of us have had harder lives than our children or people younger than us. So I think, in a sense, it gave him another sense of who I was, in a sense, by my being objectified by the other people who knew and dealt with me.
In the novel, Willie, the girl who's going to be one of the students integrating the schools, she's such the good student that one of the boys she knows basically accuses her of being a real goody-goody and a real debutante when she's not. Did you go through that kind of thing, too?
Well, I went through much worse. I didn't take it up in the book because I had so much to deal with, but I guess one of the things that made me who I am is that I really lived in an environment where even then, I mean, we hear a lot today about helping to shape young black males, but I lived in an environment where that was done as a practice of life, and I was a competitive being. I don't think I knew that then, but I was pretty competitive, and I used to like to beat the boys in quizzes and to, you know, prove myself to be the smartest kid in class, and I took some lumps for that, and I was occasionally asked to take second prize for things I had won in order to allow male students to be perceived to be in the leadership sort of position in the class. And that happened in other places other than the classroom. And it crushed me. It really did. It was one of those things I came home and took up with my father because I didn't understand. My father had given me this fairly false notion that, you know, life is a meritocracy and you go out there, you do the work, you get ahead, you get acknowledged if you succeed on these objective forms of accomplishment like Hess and things like that, that they are not political. And so I learned at 10 or 11 that they were, in fact, political and subject to change. So I think by the time I came to college and in the Black student movement at Columbia, I discovered women were stuffing envelopes. I'd had my fill of it, and several of us really just sort of burst out with, I guess, a lifetime of anger in the midst of the Black student meeting starting in 66 at Columbia. We, as freshmen, came in there and raised a lot of hell because we'd had a lot of that.
I think for a lot of people of your generation, they started participating in protests and pickets and boycotts and so on when they were teenagers, older teenagers, 17, 18, 19, 16 maybe. But you started participating in demonstrations and boycotts when you were 12, which is pretty young. Mm-hmm. Were you ever really frightened, especially considering you were in the South, there might have been police dogs mm-hmm. at the demonstrations as there are in scenes in your novel?
No, I wasn't. I'll tell you, when I came to Barnard, most of the girls who came, Black girls who came in that year, there were 19 of us, were from the South, and most of us had experienced that. I don't think in the South that my experience was unusual, because the primary organizational tool in the South was the church, and they brought children, and that was a practice fairly early in the movement, and I think most people probably experienced marches mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. I also didn't find it frightening because, one, there wasn't a lot of violence in my town, but there's a sense of sheltering in a crowd of people consisting of everyone you know, that you have a sense that whatever happens, it's okay, because this is everyone you've ever known your whole life, or almost, and it doesn't feel as out of control as it felt for me in 1968 in New York City at a march against the war in Vietnam, where horses just charged us. I felt like I was going to get trampled and my father would never hear of me again. That was much more just anonymous and frightening, and the scope of it was quite large. Whereas in a southern town, you sort of know the faces you're looking at.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Talani Davis. Her new novel, 1959, is about the early days of desegregation, and it's told through the eyes of a 12-year-old girl. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Talani Davis is my guest. In the town that you write about, and I suspect in the town you grew up in as well, there are a lot of boycotts once the civil rights movement got underway, boycotts of white businesses that banned blacks from coming in or from sitting at the counter. What effects did that have on the black community? Did it bring you together? Did it strengthen the black community?
The boycotts did a lot of things. Yes, it brought us together. I think it also brought out a lot of creative energy. People had to find creative solutions to some of the needs that were not being served because we were boycotting stores. I'm curious to this day what people did when they needed nails, mundane things like that. But as far as, like, for instance, we couldn't go to movies. And there were a lot of venues for seeing what were usually old movies. But there were block parties started around that time also. Lots of activities that never existed before. All of the youth groups at churches had many more dances in the summertime. I think partly because people were working together more closely on a day-to-day basis, and also to sort of keep people with a lot of restless energy from, you know, seeking other things to do at a time when there had been already very few places for young people to go.
What impact did the boycotts have on the white businesses?
I think the boycotts were a big shock to white businesses in southern towns. I don't think they'd ever sat down and figured out, as they would have today, what percentage of their shoppers were black people in town. They, by and large, were somewhere between 40% and 60% of the business. So very quickly, it had an immediate intense impact on daily business when black people stopped going in. And in my hometown, they lasted about a year. I know in North Carolina, there was one town that boycotted for 5 years before they had a serious negotiation. But in my hometown, the boycotts put people out of business very quickly, some of them.
So did the town really change?
The town changed totally. The main street of the town never came back. Businesses that left did not return, and smaller enterprises were bought up by chains and never reopened their doors. And people who wanted to stay in business had to move out to shopping centers because basically business stopped, and the center of town began to fail. I think that was pretty much the model, too.
What do you think the permanent impact has been on you of that experience of having been chosen to integrate a school, although the school never went through with it, so you never had to follow through, but you were chosen, you were observed, and you were preparing yourself for it?
The permanent impact of that was to give me a fairly bad attitude about the whole idea. And by that, I did try to write about this in the book, but by that I mean that the unstated question at hand in the integration situation was, were these kids good enough to be in a school with a mix of every kind of white student that might have lived in my hometown? And the assumption was that we were not as smart as the least intelligent white kid in that school. And it gave me this notion that, in a sense, a lot of people are raised with, that people are always measuring you, and as a black person, you have to go in and do better. But it gave me a bad attitude about that, that made me very competitive, but at the same time ingrained in me a notion that I had to prove nothing. I do not have to prove that I'm a human being. And maybe some people come to that later in life when they get into adulthood and they realize they don't have to explain themselves to anyone or defend themselves. But I knew I was a human being when I was 10, and when it was questioned when I was 12, it brought a certain anger to me that I'm still dragging around, I think.
So you knew you were a human being when you were 10. What happened when you were 10?
Well, I'm saying by that time, I had been raised in an environment where I had all the possibilities of any human being. So by the time the question was raised with me, whether I was as good as somebody I'd never set eyes on in my life, it wasn't a question to me. But it really made me wonder about the world I lived in where they were asking the question. And I guess my question was, well, who's asking? You know, who is that? Who wants to know?
So this idea of that you don't have to prove anything to anyone, how did that affect you in later years?
Oh, it affected me in bad ways and good. I you know, when I went to college, I did voter registration my freshman year when I maybe should have been going to class. And if I got called in about it, I would say it's just as important to me to do voter registration as go to your class. I don't have to prove to you that I can make it through this school. When I went to Barnard, a fairly large proportion of the black women in my class were put on a program to take 6 years to get through the school. They were not asked if they would like to do this, but they were assumed not to be able to do it in the normal way, and they were given three classes instead of five. And I was not one of those, but they did want to know what I was doing with my time in the way a parent would. And I had a bad attitude about it because I knew I could handle the work there and I would be fine, you know. So I would get into conflict with them, perhaps more than the next student, because I had some sense that I was dealing with a hostile environment that was asking that question again. You know, that's how I reacted to it. When I came there, I had studied French for 8 years, and they asked me to be tested and to start in French 1 or 2 or something. And my response was, put me in the last year and let me flunk it. Because I knew I could make it, but I knew the institution would ask the question. And so I wasn't totally cooperative with the institution's idea of who I was supposed to be. And so it gave me what I would call a bad attitude, or a slight, you know, a rebellious attitude and a certain arrogance. And, I don't know that all of that was useful to me, but I think that really stemmed from my childhood experiences.
Talani Davis, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Talani Davis is the author of the new novel, 1959. This is Fresh Air.